Hi, everybody. Welcome again to CeraVe Conversation, brought to you by IHS Market. My name is Atul Arya. I'm Chief Energy Strategist here at IHS Market. Today, we are going to have a very interesting conversation about the mitigation of greenhouse gas emissions and how should we model those and how should we think about that. So I think the audience, the CeraVe Conversation audience, is well aware of what we call the dual challenge. The world needs more energy, but at the same time, more energy because there is more population, more economic development, but also lower emissions in order to meet the climate challenge. So globally, we have seen in 2019, we saw a small reduction in greenhouse gas emissions. Prior to that, the emissions have been increasing, and we were going to discuss that, and IEA has done interesting work on it at CeraVe. We're going to discuss that at CeraVe, which did not happen. So we are taking the opportunity to discuss some of those issues today in this conversation. So we know that the emissions went down during the pandemic, but that was at a very big cost, you know, economic as well as human cost, and clearly not sustainable. But we do need to reduce emissions globally and in around the world in each country. So what we're going to talk about today is the transition challenge, how we should think about reducing emissions across all the different sectors. We will have a preview of the model called Sesame model, developed by MIT here in Massachusetts, in Boston, in Cambridge, I should say. And then also we will look to see how we should look at cross-sectoral approach. So a lot of different things to talk about, and I have three outstanding panelists joining me today. First of all, very pleased to have Laszlo Varro, who is the chief economist at the International Energy Agency. Laszlo, welcome to CeraVe Conversation. Laszlo joining us from Paris. And then we have Bob Armstrong. Bob is the director of the MIT Energy Initiative. We had Bob in a CeraVe Conversation a few weeks back. Bob, welcome to you as well.
Thank you.
And then Emre Genzer, who is the principal investigator and research scientist at MIT and the leader of the Sesame project. And Emre, welcome to CeraVe Conversation.
Thank you.
So I'm going to start with Laszlo, you at IEA. So, you know, you have been doing a lot of work around energy transition and the importance of going to a different energy system with lower emissions. So tell us about what IEA is doing and how should we think about the challenge of energy transition?
Well, the International Energy Agency's mandate is to work with governments towards a secure and sustainable and economically efficient energy system. And part of that is our work assessing the consequences of government policies as are being implemented. The energy system is very strongly influenced by government policy. Over two-thirds of total investment in the energy system is driven by government policies, regulations, mandates, standards, and so on. Now, in the trajectory of the global energy system in the past couple of years leading to the coronavirus crisis, we were traveling in a trajectory where, with a bit of a simplification, we had enough innovation, enough clean energy investment, and enough efficiency improvements to compensate for the growth of global population and the increasing global prosperity in emerging economies to keep global carbon dioxide emissions almost stagnant. So if we had a good year, then we might have had stagnating carbon dioxide emissions. If we had a bad year, we might have had increasing carbon dioxide emissions. Now, of course, stagnating global carbon dioxide emissions is a very good news. It's much better than the previous dynamic increase that we observed up until roughly 2015. But there is a very clear scientific consensus that given that it is the cumulative carbon dioxide emissions that determine climate change, in order to stabilize the climate, what we need to do with carbon dioxide emissions is not to stabilize them, but to bring them then eventually to zero. So we also run an analysis which is called the sustainable development scenario, which is, as the name suggests, is consistent with our value 2 degrees climate stabilization. And in our sustainable development scenario, global carbon dioxide emissions decline by more than the current emissions of the United States and Europe combined in just 10 years. and then converge towards zero. So just to illustrate the scale of the decarbonization challenge, we estimate that this year, the coronavirus crisis will cut global carbon dioxide emissions by around 8%. And the price of that is an unprecedentedly serious global recession and several million people losing their jobs. Now, in the sustainable development decarbonization pathway, just 5 years from now, global carbon dioxide emissions would need to be lower than today. And next time, we want to achieve that without shutting down the global economy. Consequently, we need to scale up investment in all clean energy sources. And again, oversimplifying a very, very complex modeling process, three things will need to be done. One is to ramp up investment and ramp up production into low-carbon electricity generating technologies, like wind power, solar power, but also nuclear power, and transform the power system so that they can integrate them. The second is, given that electricity today is only 20% of energy consumption, electrify the energy system as much as possible. Mm-hmm. So replace the direct use of oil in vehicles with electric cars, replace the direct use of natural gas in building heating with electric heat pumps, and so on. So electrify everything which is reasonable to electrify. And then the third step is to have a plan B for those applications which are not reasonable to electrify, which would mean apply carbon capture and storage on industrial energy use, bring in hydrogen for high temperature applications, use synthetic fuels for vehicles that are too heavy or travel too long distance for electricity. So essentially, the first step, ramp up low carbon electricity. Second step, electrify everything which can be reasonably electrified. And the third step, do something else on things which cannot be electrified. So this is the basic principle. And we do a lot of work with governments around the world on regulatory and policy design and investment frameworks to actually make it happen.
So a very quick follow-up here, Laszlo. You are also developing, you're well known for developing your own outlooks and your own tools. So can you say a little bit about what kind of tools you're developing? And then before I go to Bob, your collaboration with MIT.
So the two key publications from the IEA is the World Energy Outlook. The World Energy Outlook is looking at a 20-year time horizon, and its sister publication is the Energy Technology Perspectives, which is looking at the half a century time horizon. So the World Energy Outlook looks at the time frame when we have to mobilize investment to already off-the-shelf technologies like wind turbines, the current technology of nuclear reactors, or efficient end-use technologies. And you have to push investment to the already existing technologies very, very hard. Otherwise, already in the next decade or so, we pump so much carbon dioxide to the air that the game will be up. But the already existing technologies, in our view, can significantly reduce global carbon dioxide emissions, but cannot get us all the way. In order to get us all the way, we also need to accelerate innovation into technologies which today still at a laboratory phase or a demonstration project phase. Mm-hmm. And so the Energy Technology Perspectives is looking at the second stage of the journey when those technologies come into play. And interestingly enough, in the World Energy Outlook, we finished the World Energy Outlook with global carbon dioxide emissions declining by half from the current level. And the Energy Technology Perspectives is taking care of the other half. But for the second half of the journey, we have a large-scale application of technologies which still require a substantial research development and innovation funding.
Thank you, Laszlo. Moving to Bob. So Bob, of course, MIT and MIT Energy Initiative, which you lead, are at the forefront of looking at the challenge of decarbonization. So could you talk about all the, you know, the tools and the capabilities you have been developing over the years and the latest Sesame tool you have developed, now Sesame model?
Sure, thank you very much, Atul. So we since our beginning, we've been looking not only at innovating in specific technologies, so better solar systems, lowering costs of nuclear power, innovating in fusion, developing better batteries for storage, novel battery technologies that you get to long duration storage. But we've also been looking at the techno-economics of those technologies and doing that with a common method across all those technology areas, including carbon capture, utilization and storage, batteries or storage technologies, generally solar energy, fission, fusion, and so on. As Laszlo pointed out, we have been seeing increasing overlap between sectors in which we deploy power. So power used to go into providing electricity for buildings and so on. And now we see it in an increasing way taking part in electrifying transportation, so starting to have an impact there. Starting to move, not as far as in transportation, but starting to move into the industrial sector as we think about how we could switch from thermochemistry to electrochemistry in certain processes to take advantage of the low carbon technologies becoming more available in the power sector. So we see this not just interesting understanding that we need within a sector, right? So within the power sector, but understanding what the cross-sectoral implications are. And that's because that there are lots of possible routes to get to an end goal. So to provide low carbon transportation, we can get there beginning with fossil fuels if we go to, say, hydrogen with those fossil fuels and strip off the carbon and sequester it, and then go to a hydrogen fuel cell vehicle. You can get there by more efficient vehicles. You can do that with hybrid vehicles, plug-in hybrid vehicles, get part of the way there. You could also get there by electrifying transportation, of course, which we see increasingly by battery electric vehicles. But in understanding how well you're doing with a pathway like that, you need analytical tools that allow you to look at the entire life cycle analysis on that pathway. So begin with the source of energy, could be solar or wind, say, what is the life cycle impact of producing electricity that way? What are the emissions associated with that? What are the emissions associated with the transmission system to get you to the vehicle? What's the emissions impact of building the vehicle, including mining the materials that go into the batteries and so on? So what does that entire thing look like? And how does that compare with all the other pathways you could use to provide those transportation services? And that issue replicates throughout the energy system, right? Any service we want, how do we get there? And that generates a multitude of pathways, and you need an efficient tool to help you decide whether you are a strategic planner in an industry or you're a policymaker thinking about a renewable portfolio standard. What's the impact of that on the system and the overall emissions of that system? And that's been the genesis of this SESME tool. SESME being a nice acronym for Sustainable Energy System Analysis and Modeling Environment. We're developing an open source version of that to make it available to the community at large. And so nicely, we can call that Open Sesame. Hopefully that'll let the genie out of the bottle and we can move faster in this area.
Thank you, Bob. Let's come back to the potential users and how people can benefit from the work MIT has done. But I want to go to Emory next. And Emory, could you briefly describe the model, what it does, and some of the results? So for the benefit of our audience, we are going to see some slides from Emory, and then we'll come back and have a discussion about that. So over to you, Emory.
Yeah, thank you, Atul. So briefly, Sesame is a technology assessment tools that can work on a system level. And actually, just to point out all the points Laszlo and Bob mentioned, so we are seeing a huge change in energy system, and we are seeing sectors coming together, converging, and we need some new tools to capture the dynamics of this, what's happening in energy system. So if we can see the slides, I can go over some of the more details about what is the tool, and I will also give an example of use case. So over the last couple of years, we've been working on developing this Sesame tool, and the main premise of this tool is to understand the impact of relevant technological, operational, temporal, and geospatial variables. And these are extremely important because one of the challenges of the evolving energy system is there are many variabilities, as you can see here. So temporal aspects is very important. Regional aspects are extremely important. And some of the changes we are seeing in the energy change is causing a huge change in operational emissions. So first of all, we want to bring together all the sectors in a single platform and give an easily usable platform to decision makers and policy makers to make informed decisions. So this is a snapshot of the current version of Sesame. And here you can see some of the use cases that we intend to develop this tool for. The first one is assessing and comparing technology options. So as Bob mentioned, there are many technology options, and unfortunately, there's no silver bullet. So for different applications, different regions, we need different technologies. And we need to assess properly all of these and compare these options to make the best decisions that will take us to the decarbonization targets. Performing technology and system scenario analysis is another key area. So we don't want to just give one single number and value result, because there are multitude of options and we will be able to make scenarios to compare different options. The implications of market and policy dynamics are extremely important, as highlighted by Bob, about renewable portfolio standards or other policy regulations or policies that can hugely impact the overall decisions. So we need to be able to assess all of these. And one of the key areas here that we are really proud of is the cross-sector comparisons. As Laszlo mentioned, so the electrification for many sectors, as well as using hydrogen for decarbonizing industry, is a huge driver for decarbonization. But this also have a huge impact on the power sector side. So we really need to understand how these dynamics work and how each sector will impact the other sectors. And this is one of the big novelties of the tool that we've prepared. And finally, the impacts of standard versus best practices. So this is also a huge issue, because we might have assets, but are we really operating these assets at optimal level, or can we optimize to further help the decarbonization of the system? So in the next slide, I would like to show you what is the structure that we built. So as you know, this is a huge problem, and there are many pathways that you can go. So that's why we took a modular approach here. And we started designing the energy system, defining the energy system in terms of six life cycle stages. Basically, the taking a life cycle assessment approach is extremely important, because emissions are from many different sources. So it is not, when we compare two transportation options, comparing tailpipe emissions is not enough. So we really need to see the full cycle and do an apples to apples comparison. To exactly address this issue, we took this life cycle assessment approach in defining the energy system. And here you can see we use six vectors: upstream for resources, how we explore and produce different energy sources, including renewables as well as fossils. And you can see we have an extensive list of modules, and each one of these modules has much more granularity. So for example, for solar PV, you can have different technologies like CIGS, cadmium telluride, or silicon crystal, and so on and so forth. Similarly, for fossil resources, each one of these can have different compositions, can come from different locations, so on and so forth. This is much more granular than what you are seeing in this simplified graph. Midstream is looking at how we can transport the upstream resources to the processing step with simple processes as well as transport modes like pipeline transport, shipping, so on and so forth. And one of the key focuses here is the processing step, which basically converts the resources, feedstocks to the final products as well as electricity. And seeing one of the largest amount of CO2 emissions or greenhouse gas emissions from this step. And you can see we have included many options in terms of heat and power production as well as industrial production of hydrogen, gasoline, and other chemicals. And CCUS, in our opinion, is a must for decarbonization. So there are many assets that will be running over the last 50 years, including coal power plants around the world. And if we want to decarbonize the entire system, we really need to use carbon capture as a tool. And that's exactly why we have included the entire vector, which has different CO2 separation, capture processes, utilization options, and storage options. And gate to user is looking at how we can transport the products to the end use. And under end use, we are covering major sectors, power sector, industrial sector, transportation sector, as well as buildings. So there are two ways you can interpret this graph. The first one is by using different modules that you are seeing here, we can define pathways, end-to-end pathways. But the more interesting part of the tool is when we combine pathways to define systems. And the way we are doing this, so basically a system can be as small as two pathways or as large as combination of pathways that can define a region or country. And on the pathway level, you can see there are more than 1,000 energy pathways. So it's a very comprehensive representation of the current energy space. But on the pathway, on the system, basically, there is no bound because we can combine all of these pathways to make many different systems. And in the next slide, I would like to give you an example from the transportation sector. This portion of the results has been published in our recent report on insights into future mobility, and you can download from this link. Basically, the approach here is when we compare different transportation modes for light-duty vehicles, we need to take a life cycle assessment approach. And to do so, we started comparing mid-sized sedans with different powertrains. And here, ICEVs are internal combustion engines, hybrid electric vehicles, plug-in hybrid electric vehicles, battery electric vehicles, and fuel cell electric vehicles. And with this example, I want to first show you the snapshot results. So if we take today's US grid and today's hydrogen production method, steam methane reforming without carbon capture, how these different options compare. So here you can see we have three colors, green, blue, and purple. And green refers to the vehicle production related greenhouse gas emissions. Blue is fuel production and purple is fuel consumption. And when we look at these results, the first observation is internal combustion engine has a higher carbon tag. So we are seeing approximately 40% higher emissions compared to other alternatives. But an interesting observation is we are seeing hybrids, plug-in hybrids, and fuel cell electric vehicles emitting almost at the same level. But when we look at the composition of the emissions, we are seeing as we move to vehicles with larger battery packs, actually we are seeing the vehicle production part contributing more to the overall emissions. And of course, fuel consumption emissions goes to zero for electric vehicles as well as fuel cell electric vehicles because there's no tailpipe emissions. But the main issue that we see here is that these are important results, but all of these results are dependent on the assumptions and the system of our definition. And I want to give you two examples here. So you will see sensitivity on the hydrogen production on the right-hand side here. So depending on how we produce hydrogen, including electrolysis using current grid, steam methane reforming, today's most common method in the US, steam methane reforming with carbon capture and electrolysis with wind power, you are seeing that there's a huge range of greenhouse gas emissions impacts we can C. And this is completely changing the order of fuel cell electric vehicles in relative to the other options. Another important observation here you'll see is that even with fuel cell electric vehicles using hydrogen from electrolysis produced from wind, the life cycle emissions doesn't go to zero, because we still need to manufacture vehicles, we still need to manufacture wind turbines, and unless we are completely decarbonizing the manufacturing industry, we will always have some emissions, and we need to account for all of these. The second variability I want to highlight is the ratio of battery electric vehicles versus hybrid electric vehicles. So in the 2030 timeframe, we expect to see battery hybrid electric vehicles as the standard. So we want to compare the relative advantage of battery electric vehicles compared to hybrids. And in the next slide, you will see that when we look at the US, this ratio changed quite dramatically. So in states where power production is relatively green, like Washington, where most of the electricity production is coming from hydro, actually battery electric vehicles are extremely advantageous. So there is no competition between other alternatives. So if we want to increase the decarbonization rate, we need to move to the battery electric main. But for other states where we are seeing coal in the generation mix and the emission intensity of power generation is not that low, actually, we are seeing that hybrid electric vehicles has a larger advantage compared to battery electric vehicles. So you can see the gray states here, like Colorado, Indiana, Ohio. But even we are not stopping here. And when we move to the next slide, you will see that when we charge, how we charge battery electric vehicles also have a huge impact. So just as an example, I wanted to give you two examples here, California and New York, and I will not go into details of both, but at first sight, you can see that these generation mixes are quite different, both in terms of profiles as well as the mix. But if we look into California system, so you can see that an x-axis here is the hour of the day, and y-axis is shown on the left, generation in gigawatt, the first graph, percent of total generation in the second one, and the emission intensity of power generation in the third one. And here you can see in California system, we are seeing a huge increase in solar, but solar energy is only available during daytime. So this is, first of all, shifting the profiles of other generating capacity, including natural gas power plants. First of all, this has an impact on existing plants because we are running natural gas power plants at a part load with frequent startup and shutdowns, which is increasing the emission intensity of these assets. But furthermore, this has a huge impact in the overall emission intensity of the system. And you can see in the final graph, actually during the hour of the day, we have solar energy, the emission intensity of grid is quite low. And if we want to really take advantage of this portion, we need to charge our vehicles during this period of time. And when we move to other time periods, the emission intensity is quite stable. And on the graph below the map, you can see we compare three different charging times for California system and New York system. And you can see the difference of overall environmental impact can be as high as 50%, depending on the charging time. And another interesting observation here is actually you can see for California, midday charging is advantageous, while in New York, overnight charging is advantageous. So, and when we look at each one of these states, these results shuffles and we see a completely different set of results. And in the next slide, I want to give an overview of the system level implications of these trends. And we compared two projections for EV market share and overall greenhouse gas emissions. And on the left-hand side, we looked at EIA's 2019 business as usual case. And the right-hand side graph is showing the BNEF's 2019 graph projections. Yellow here is battery electric vehicles, green is internal combustion engine, and blue is hybrid electric vehicles.
Just for our audience, Amber, EIA is the Energy Information Agency here in the US, and BNF stands for Bloomberg New Energy Finance, right?
Yeah. So you can see completely different projection sets here. So the EIA's base case scenario is very conservative. We don't see much battery electric vehicle mix in the fleet. And BNEF is looking a very aggressive battery electric vehicle adoption rate. So when we look at these two figures, actually the expectation is for BNEF case, we should see a huge decline in overall life cycle GHG emissions. But when you see the results here, so in these two cases, the first observation you'll see is that we are seeing a decline irrespective of the scenario we are taking. So for both cases, we will see a overall reduction in emissions from transportation sector, light duty transportation sector, although the fleet is growing quite dramatically from approximately 250 million to 350 million vehicles. But overall emissions, when you look at the 2050 numbers, are quite similar. So in the case for higher battery electric adoption, it is slightly lower, but it is not dramatically lower. And this is mostly when you switch to battery electric vehicles, as I mentioned earlier, if you cannot totally decarbonize the value chain, how you manufacture vehicles, how you manufacture devices that will produce renewable power, actually you will always have some life cycle emissions. And the benefit you will be getting will be limited. Just we need to understand all of these dynamics when we are making decisions. And this tool that we've developed, Sesame, can provide these kind of insights to optimize our decisions and make the decisions that will take us to the maximum decarbonization race with minimum cost. So I'll stop here and happy to follow up.
Yes, so thank you, Emre. This is, as I would describe, just a snapshot of a very sophisticated model, and you have done a fabulous job. I have a very quick question, and then I'll start a broader discussion around the model itself. You have carbon capture. Are you thinking about adding other carbon reduction technologies like direct air capture and so on?
Absolutely. So we have started with the commercially available technologies, but currently we are looking at emerging technologies, including direct air capture, methane pyrolysis, and other technologies that might have a breakthrough technology to further reduce emissions.
Okay, great. Thank you. So Laszlo, I want to come back to you from an IEA perspective. What do you see as some of the applications of the Sesame model? And are you planning to use that internally within the IEA as well?
Well, the IEA, we have had a very organic and very deep professional friendship with MIT, if I might say so. So I personally have been a regular visitor at the MIT campus, and I'm looking forward to this post-epidemic world where I can personally visit again. So we are always very happy to consider and incorporate the results from the MIT's work into our work. On the other hand, the IEA has spent 20 years developing in-house modeling capabilities, and there's a very clear request from our member states through the IEA governing board that the IEA should continue to do so. So my expectation is that we are definitely going to look at it, and we're definitely going to consider it, but its primary use from our point of view will be to help us fine-tuning, calibrating, and modernizing our in-house modeling work. I would think that a tool like Sesame will have a very important role to play outside the IEA, because given the IEA's mandate and professional background, we have our internal modeling capabilities. But in my experience, the professional quality of the public discourse on energy and climate issues is strikingly weak. And I very often had to remind the people that with a parliamentary majority, you can modify your energy law, but you cannot modify the laws of thermodynamics even with a parliamentary majority. So we actually had our series of publications, which we call the blind spot series, where we recognized that the public discourse, you know, the debate on the energy transition on social media, the political media discussion, is excessively focuses on certain things which are useful but would not solve the entire problem, and very important parts of the energy transition are subject to a blind spot, and we even had a publication series trying to address this. So I think having a publicly available analytical tool which maps the complexity of the energy system with its physical basis in a scientifically appropriate manner, and it is published by an organization like the MIT, which has a global reputation unquestioned by almost anyone, I think that can have a very, very important contribution in raising the quality of the public discourse on the energy transition.
That's a really good point. And actually, Bob, I want to ask you one question around the results which Emory just showed. Were you surprised by the last chart, the comparison of the, you know, deep penetration of EVs versus a shallow penetration, and not such a big, if I eyeball the numbers, they were sort of within the range, right? So not a huge decline in emission, decline in both cases. Was that a surprise to you, Bob?
Yeah, so let me say a couple of things about that. So first, I think it's surprising for sure, because I think the expectation is that if you electrify transportation, then you've won the battle. And the message from that graph is, no, you haven't. What it points to is this coupling across sectors that you have got to decarbonize the whole energy system. So as Remy pointed out, there's a mining, transportation, manufacturing set of issues, so you can decarbonize that entire supply chain. Secondly, in that set of slides, I thought another very interesting piece, the slide before that one, was the difference between California and New York, which was striking, right? And that points to, I think, one of the really key features in dealing with climate change mitigation going forward, and that's the heterogeneity in the system, right? Different regions in the U.S. or around the world, and more importantly, have different energy resources. And as they decarbonize, they're going to need to do that differently, taking into account their resources and how best to exploit those. So one of the things we're actually doing now with IEA GOT is to take this model and bring it to different parts of the world, different regions around the world, and make this tool openly available to governments and companies around the world so that they can use this to inform their decision making at the policy level, but also at corporate levels as companies around the world think about their own strategies to minimize emissions in the most economic way. They can make intelligent decisions as well, but not in isolation.
Yeah. So before we wrap, I have a question, same question both for you, Laszlo, and Bob, which is around, you know, what is interesting is this challenge of decarbonization. And Laszlo, you put the frame around, you know, electrify, use clean electricity, and then do carbon capture and things like that for anything where you can't use clean sources of energy. But the one thing, the work from MIT is showing that even within that framework, there are going to be some pretty significant challenges, isn't it? Like the manufacturing challenge in the EVs is just one example of it. So what should our audience take away from this kind of analysis? So I'll start with you, Laszlo.
I would pose a couple of questions, which I'm being asked by policymakers, issues which are rising on the political agenda in the context of the energy transition, and where I feel that a more granular, deeper academic research would be of a great help. So if I can have a Christmas wish list of which direction the MIT research should go. One is for a time we were thinking about wind and solar as infinitely scalable resources, and this is simply not true under realistic political assumptions. Mm-hmm. There are many, many examples of jurisdictions where, you know, you put down the first 100 wind turbines and everybody is happy about clean energy, and you put there 1,000 wind turbines and you run into a serious political trouble with local communities and so on. This is even true to some extent even for solar. So I think we need to have much more granular analysis on the land use and also the infrastructure, needs. I can tell you that in every single energy system model that I'm aware of, we need a significant expansion of the electricity network to deal with the energy transition. Now, in real life, global investment in electricity networks have been declining since 2015, continuously year after year. So the infrastructure and the land use aspects of the new energy system, I say, are going to be extremely important, and they are rising on the agenda. We already touched upon the material needs. This is also an issue which is rising on the agenda. That we already have 5% of global silver mining going into solar panel manufacturing, and this is still a fraction of the solar production that we are envisaged. And of course, we are talking about mid-century and energy system where the heavy mining machinery in the Peruvian silver mine will have to run on a low carbon source, and the ship transporting that to China will have to run on a low carbon source, and so on. So there are increasing the intense questions about the critical materials, and also policymakers are asking the question of, should we bet only on this technology? Is the material needs manageable? Are we opening new geopolitical vulnerabilities, and so on? And last but not least, the industrial supply chains. In practically every clean energy investment program that is initiated in the hope of creating green jobs. Now, in some cases, those green jobs really materialize. In other cases, not. Everybody would like to develop an export-oriented competitive cluster of clean energy technologies. But given that we have not yet made contact with alien beings, so we cannot export solar panels to Jupiter. So if somebody exports, somebody else has to import. So I think we also need to have more granular information of the technological and industrial processes behind clean energy technologies, and to what extent the policy hopes about job creation and creating industrial clusters are realistic, and what are the policies which can make it happen. So these are the things which I feel to be topics that are rapidly rising on the agenda, and where I feel that it's currently, I would say, over-debated but under-researched.
Yes, absolutely. So Bob, you have a little bit of a Christmas wish list from Laszlo. What do you think?
Yeah, so I actually like his wish list a lot. Now we're opening the presents now at MIT, and already through this IEA GOT program I mentioned, we are coupling Sesame. We focus here on Sesame, but in this program we couple Sesame with an integrated assessment model. Yes. Which is a macroeconomic model of the world, which allows you to address a number of those questions that Laszlo just raised. And they are very serious questions. People care a lot about the economic impacts of these decisions and choices. Jobs is an obvious one right now, particularly in the COVID-19 environment. Social license to employ some of these technologies is an issue, and it will vary around the world. So what is acceptable in one part of the world is not in a different part of the world. We need to understand that land use impacts have a big effect on some technologies, biomass, for example. But even more wind and solar deployment, as Laszlo mentioned, can be affected by land use impacts. So there's, in fact, a very long list there, and we work with the joint program at MIT, which has developed a really outstanding model, EPA, the Emissions Prediction and Policy Analysis Model, which is part of the program we have. So we have an interface between EPA and Sesame, which actually was buried in some of those results Emery showed on transportation.
Thank you, Bob. Thank you, Laszlo, and thank you, Emery, for a very fascinating discussion. And I think what this highlights for me is that energy transition is a challenge, is going to, you know, how it unfolds is nobody actually really knows, but there are some very interesting opportunities and of course, very big challenges. I should mention in the closing that we within IHS Markets Energy team are also looking at this issue of resource availability and materials. And we have a project called New Energy Supply Chain. So if any of our audience is interested in learning more about that, we'll be happy to talk. So with that, thank you again. And this is CERAWeek Conversations presented to you by IHS Markit.